Hi, this is Tony Robbins again. Before you begin to listen to this interview with William Strauss and Neil Howe, I want to give you some reasons to listen to it. I want to tell you a little bit about how it came about because I really want to get you compelled to listen to the whole thing and to really take the time to absorb it, because this interview, the understanding these two men have brought to our society and to the world, is truly historic. Now, I know that sounds like hyperbole, but they're pretty famous. They've written books that have been acknowledged by presidents of countries from around the world. The one that grabbed me a few years ago was called The Fourth Turning, An American Prophecy. And what the book does is basically show you how throughout humanity's history, with absolute precision, we go through emotional cycles, dark times, light times. Think of them as seasons, if you would. And that if you don't understand what season you're living in, you're going to be very frustrated. And the reason is, if you do the right thing at the wrong time, you're not going to be rewarded. You're going to say, wait, I'm doing all the right things. How come I'm not rewarded? Well, if you plant in the summertime, I don't care how hard you worked at it, you're not going to get any kind of reward when the fall comes. You have to do the right thing at the right time. And not knowing where we are in history is a challenge. And most people are not interested in history. In fact, when I did this interview, you know, the book was a very intense book. It was written for people that were either interested in history or interested in understanding the future. And the general population didn't jump all over it. And that's one of the reasons I interviewed them. And when we got ready to publish the interview, we tested it. And many people said, well, you know, it's interesting, but, you know, who cares? And at some point in the near future, you know, our whole society is going to change the way it looks at its security, for example. You know, like that's really going to happen. And so we had so many other things to publish that we didn't put it out. Well, after September 11th, I decided this interview had to be made public, obviously. And I think you're going to find it amazing because in this interview, these two men have predicted with precision the events of terrorism, the events of anthrax and its type of usage, and you'll understand why they're able to predict it. It's not like hypnosis. These men are economists, historians, one's from Yale, one's from Harvard, but what they're showing you are the patterns of history. Understanding them can give you an enormous breakthrough in how you plan, design your life, and take care of your family, and create success in your future. So what I've done to help out is I've condensed the three-hour interview into this little package. And then after September 11th, I went and interviewed them again so you can get an understanding of how they view that experience is consistent or inconsistent with their predictions and what it can mean to your life, to your business, to your family today. So there's a lot to absorb here. Enjoy it, please. I think it could be a great, interesting approach. And again, you can look at it as saying, maybe they're wrong. But wouldn't it be good to at least be aware of their predictions and figure out how to take advantage of them? So without any further ado, let's listen in as we begin our Power Talk interview now. What we're going to be really talking about is how America and the world goes through cycles, moods, if you will, and how those are seasonal in nature. And so we have a very important session, and I'm really, really grateful to be here just outside the Beltway. We're here in Virginia with Neil, and to be in a position, Neil's home, I should say, and to be in a position with you, Bill, that we get to really hear about your lives as well as about your work. So first of all, thank you for having us in your home, Neil. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate it. Great you came here, Tony.
Thank you. So I'd like to start out with giving people a little background of how did this come together? How did this all start out?
We began wanting to present a story of generational endowments, how each generation provided or didn't provide something for the future. But as we looked more closely, we saw the relationship between the GI generation, the people who are presently in their late 70s on up, and the boomers,
right,
who we define as between 1943 and 1960 birth cohorts, people in their late 30s to middle 50s now. That relationship had existed before. It especially existed after the Revolution.
Really?
With the babies born right after the Revolution having a similar kind of relationship to the young hero soldiers of the Revolution. Abraham Lincoln's transcendental generation was a boomer-like generation, just as Thomas Jefferson's generation, two generations older, very much resembled the generation that fought and won World War II.
Right.
And interestingly, amazingly, even the generation in between had the same kind of a post-heroic quality. The ones who were the children of World War II and the children of the Revolution had the same attitudes towards leadership, towards the family.
Right. So tell me, in a sentence or two, because we're going to talk about this in depth, what is the most important message of the fourth turning? What can we learn from? What does it offer us today, not just in history?
What it tells you is that history counts, and it counts for you as a person. Because as a society, as well as individuals, there are ways that we can prepare for what we know history will offer around the next bend.
So when you have an awareness of what's coming, you can take advantage of it. You can live life on your terms rather than just plunging forward into the darkness.
Yeah. If you know what the seasons are, you can take advantage of the next season that's coming.
So let's first just look at those four phases or seasons of a human life. You describe them from 0 to 20 as being childhood, where we're basically dependent upon society, where we're learning, we're taking in values, and that's really the role we play. We're dependent. I guess the second cycle here is where a person's a young adult, and we go through a passage usually. What's really our role in that young adulthood, that 21 to, I guess, 41 years old?
Well, that's the time when we're beginning to test values, we're building families, we're getting married, we're providing society's muscle, which may be applied to different purposes, you know, collectively and individually, depending on the era. But this is the time we're really starting out our adult life, beginning to identify who we are. We've done our learning, we've finished our dependence. I should say, too, that this passage, this rite of passage between youth and young adulthood is one of the best defined in nearly all cultures. You know, whether you have to jump off a tree suspended by a vine or whatever it is, you have to face a time of stepping outside and stepping back in to define this. And each of these phases of life are often celebrated in cultures as having a really fixed time at which you're expected to enter a new role. And certainly that's true from childhood to young adulthood.
Right.
Now the next phase of life that we identify is midlife, which we, again, just add another 21, 22 years. So that would be basically from your early 40s to your mid-60s.
Well, and realize as a society, we tend to consider about a 43-year-old individual as old enough to be president.
Right.
As old enough to be a CEO, as old enough to be a judge, as old enough to hold any position of responsibility.
Right. And this is basically when we have the most influence over institutions, over the culture. We're basically running society, not just running our own families or our own personal lives. And we have to dedicate so much attention to them in our late 20s and in our 30s.
Right.
But we're basically applying this energy to society as a whole. And then typically, now we define it as somewhere between age 62 and age 65, 65 being the great Social Security year of entitlement,
sure,
is the next passage, which is the passage into seniorhood or elderhood, and that too is a different relationship. One often becomes dependent again financially upon society, upon your children. You're supposed to disengage, at least how different generations do disengage is a different subject.
Right.
But this is a time where your physical powers aren't as strong,
right,
and you're looking for ways to contribute, and particularly you're focused in elderhood on how to prepare universally recognized, widely recognized as being different phase of life with very different characters, very different, and important for our discussion, very different expected social roles.
And as you think about your own life cycle, you realize that during each of those seasons of life, you should be preparing for the next one.
Right.
And you also should not be behaving the way people did in the prior one.
Right.
So you see, when you're a young adult, you shouldn't behave like a child anymore. When you're in midlife, you really shouldn't behave like an apprentice.
Right.
And as you start overlaying the seasons of life onto the seasons of history, you can see how that's important.
Well, now let's do that, because I think this will give people great clarity. A winter, of course, being the elderhood for people as they begin to actually deal with the idea of their own mortalities you described and
right,
wanting to have some meaning for their life, which is the legacy. But if we look at history now, throughout history, since Roman times, as you pointed out, we had 12 centuries, or saeculum, I guess is how it's pronounced, the initial term. Those 80 to 100-year periods of time that we measure, that is the length of a human life. And history is related to a human life has seasons.
67 years. That's how it is. Between crises, right.
That's right. So let's describe that for people. Give them a little more clarity then about these seasons. And then let's talk about what happens, for example, for people in that first phase of life of childhood, and let's give them the terms, because what you're really saying here is there are four different types of generations that follow each other in order, just like the seasons. You don't jump from springtime instantly to winter any more than you go from fall to springtime and skip a winter.
Right.
So please describe that.
Well, when you think of the seasons of time and of history, they are the four turnings. The first turning we call a high, which is right after the last great crisis, like springtime. 1946 to 1963, the springtime, and realize that during the springtime, it is the boomer-type generations who are entering childhood, being born. So you see, the boomer-type generation has its own springtime during history's springtime.
And so
boomers lead their own life cycle in a way that exactly matches the seasons of history. And that's part of what creates their own drama. That one great drama has just ended, and just as they are dying, another great drama will end. It's actually a good life cycle from the standpoint of drama.
Keep in mind that the great elder leaders of all of America's crises, you think of FDR, MacArthur, you think of Abraham Lincoln, or you think of Sam Adams, all of these elder leaders in great crises were born very shortly after the last great crisis.
Right? You can go back five times, all the way back to the end of the Middle Ages, and you'll see it as always the babies born after one great crisis who, as elders, become the great champions. Think about the boomer life cycle.
Okay.
Every generation has its own drama here, but look at theirs. It's a diagonal. They are entering childhood, being born during the high of the first turning. They are entering young adulthood, changing the culture during the awakening.
So let's be clear about that. They're going from 21 to, they're 21 to 41 age group, becoming young adulthood.
During the consciousness revolution.
What you call an awakening.
The second turning, yes, awakening. And then you have the third turning, which is the unraveling, and they are now in midlife.
They're in power. So let's take an example. A person who fits that generation was being born during the good times would be somebody like Bill Clinton, as an example. He's the leading edge, right?
Right.
So he grows up in that good time. He comes of age during the questioning.
Right. He's very much
that way. Movie revolutions,
right.
Cultural revolutions.
Dodges the draft and very much a kid of the 60s, and then he comes back.
He's president. He's in his power.
He's very much a third-turning president, representing several sides of the boomer personality, but just as you look at Bill Clinton, you would also look at Hillary Clinton, whose moral severity is really more at the heart of what you see in boomers. You see that on the other side with the Rush Limbaughs and the Bill Bennetts.
Remember, with each of these generations, their fixation on the coming-of-age experience remains in some way a fixation throughout their life. So boomers, which came of age with this new explosion and discovery of values and the focus on values and moral priorities, that's going to be with them until the rest of their lives.
They're going to be wearing blue jeans at all age.
But in a different way, depending upon their phase of life. They're still focused on culture and priorities and spirituality, only now it's in a midlife way of being
that's
focused,
right.
which
right.
is in many ways a little more severe and a little grimmer than it was back in the springtime of their lives, and it will still remain a focus in elderhood with an even different effect.
Right.
Yeah. So you think of boomers entering old age during the fourth turning, that completes the diagonal of their own life cycle.
Right.
The winter of their lives in the winter of history.
Right, and now they're going to be entering a world in which there'll be no economic support for Social Security. They know it now, but it's very different when they're going to get a check.
We think that they will make the opposite trade from what their own parents made. Rather than taking the money and giving up the culture, they will give up some of the money and take hold of the culture, not want to let go of the culture.
Meaning they'll want to mold the youth, they'll want to mold the society
exactly.
as a whole.
Yes, churches.
Nothing more important for boomers than to keep the megaphones right there in their own hand. And they're going to be performing musical concerts and writing essays and doing everything they can to extend their grasp over the culture.
They will still be the talking heads on cable.
Yes, exactly. And they'll still be writing for style sections of every newspaper in America. They will just gray with them.
Right.
But you see, this is the opposite of their GI generation parents,
right.
who kept economic and political institutions but absolutely disappeared from the culture.
So this is one of the four archetypes, and you call this the prophet generation.
The prophet archetype,
and it shows up. It has different terms for each generation, but they have the same qualities.
It's the same kind as Franklin Roosevelt or Abraham Lincoln's
right.
generation.
They walk through the same phases.
Okay, well then you can take the next one.
Great.
The ones born after boomers, what we call the nomad archetype. This is like Generation X.
Right.
Okay, they are being born during a second turning. Their spring is during history's summer.
So let's be clear about that. Their birth is happening, if we talk about that in terms of the summer for us, what are the years for the summer of this?
Say 1964 to 1984.
So 64 to 84. So they went through, they were born in the uprisings of the 60s, the total revolution of how we think about sexuality and society and everything else. And their parents were immersed in that, so their parents were not there to protect them as the previous parents were doing, correct?
That's right.
And one of the major reasons I understand that we see these generational focuses is because generations not only experience different events, but kids are raised radically differently from one generation to the next.
They were the children, and Generation X we actually define as being born between 1961 and 1981. So it's their first real conscious moment came during the awakening, during this summertime. And that was the downtime of American protectiveness towards children. We were leaving them to their own devices. And this was when they were born, so they were the true children of that.
Well, they also grew up in a time summer. When everyone's saying, "My God, we'll be out of oil. There's gas lines."
Well, it was also a time of increased distrust in institutional life. But all that was part of the awakening. We were all questioning that. We were arguing against it. But most importantly for them, and most feelingly for them, they are very aware that they're the first babies people took pills not to have. And I mean that in a very personal sense. If you go into a room now with people in their 20s, divorce, which is an interesting concept for older generations, is a very painful and personal one for them because they experienced it in a way which most older generations didn't. That is, on the receiving end as kids.
They also were the most aborted generation in American history.
Right, so having children, you weren't real popular walking in with your child during that stage.
Well, today
it's baby on board.
Well, there was
a key survey of American women back when boomers were children. Two mothers out of three said it was better to keep a bad marriage together for the sake of the children. By the time the Xers came along, only one in three said that.
Well, that underscores another survey that I remember you describing, that now these boomers, as they come of age in that 21 to 41, because they were born in a different time and they grew up with different experiences, they look at life very differently and they don't behave the same way as the boom generation does. And the boom generation, like all generations, can't figure it out. Yeah. One of the surveys that I know you quoted was the one that I guess they did for 20 years of the boom generation while they were in college. They asked them which is more important. I'm paraphrasing.
This is the classic. Yeah, this is the UCLA poll put out by Professor Austin and others. And back in the late 60s, it showed that incoming freshmen, basically two-thirds of them thought their most important life priority was to figure out the meaning of life.
As opposed to
one-third, which thought the most important thing was to get rich.
Right.
And those today, exactly
today it's one-third, two-thirds the other way. And this is an interesting...
Well, I want to make that clear. So that means the prophets today, two-thirds are saying economics is the most important thing, meaning a life, you know, only
third. It's the nomads, the Gen X, today's young generation. And this is important, and the reason I often bring up this poll and similar polls up is to make a very important point, is that every generation contains all kinds of people.
Right.
And even back in the boomer heyday, well, there was one-third that really wanted to get rich, right?
Sure.
And today with Generation X in school, there's still one-third that thinks that they want to become spiritually enlightened. But you always know if you're a one-third to two-thirds minority, you always know where you stand with your peers.
The other thing is, it's for people to understand, it's not that one generation doesn't care, it's that this generation, for example, I hear boomers always say, they don't care about anything, X generation.
Yeah.
You know, it's that they grew up with a different set of experiences.
Absolutely.
And they saw the excesses of the baby boom generation.
I'd say they're much more survivalist oriented. They're much more pragmatic.
Boomers didn't start businesses. Right.
When we came out, we expected the seas to part for us and everybody to listen to us and to give us good jobs right away. And by and large, that happened for a lot of people, especially in cultural realms. Whereas the Gen Xers realized that they weren't being provided much. So they've gone out and started their businesses.
Well, they came of age too during downsizing in America, when all of a sudden outsourcing was big. And you graduated from Harvard and an MBA in business school, and you did that in the previous generation, you had a great job. You did it in this generation, there weren't any jobs.
So what you have with Gen X is they embody the disappearing middle class too, because you have a small number of them who are doing spectacularly, whether you're talking
technology.
About business and technology or athletics or the movie industry and whatnot. You have a small number who are doing way better than boomers ever did at the same age.
Right.
You have a pretty large hunk at the bottom end who are doing worse than boomers did, especially culturally and societally. And then you have the bunch in the middle who are losing ground.
Right. What do you mean by losing ground?
They're in the service sector. They're not making as much money.
Right.
They're having to defer marriage. A typical single male around age 30 is substantially behind where a single male boomer was in earning power 20 years ago, right, when you adjust for inflation.
Right.
So nearly everybody is losing ground.
So this doesn't create any real sense of optimism about the future, obviously.
No, and they have less security. They have fewer benefits.
One of the reasons I wanted to do this also is for those who find themselves within that generation, who feel shaped by the generation, is to realize that they have a very important place in history, which
Absolutely.
We'll talk about later on here.
Absolutely.
And that also that they really have a tremendous opportunity, that if they think in a linear form again, they'll say, this is going to be this way forever.
That's
but
right.
It's not going to be this
but
way
I,
forever.
I think it's also important to remember that every generation's weakness is its strength.
At the right time in history.
At the right time in history, and applied to the right purpose. For instance, one thing that boomers always started saying, about Xers, really sometime in the mid-1970s, and really strongly in the 1980s when Xers were in college and the boomers tended to be the professors, was, these kids, all they care about if it's going to be on the exam, right? The old question, hey, prof, is this going to be on the exam, right? And it's an interesting because although it made boomers climb the walls.
Yeah, because they said, why aren't they interested?
Don't you care, right?
Yeah.
Don't you really care about the truth?
But in a crisis, you want to care about what's on the exam. Anything else you want to blot out.
If you turn that attitude around, it becomes an extremely pragmatic, powerful tool for focusing exactly on what's necessary.
What
that is, what is going to be on the exam? I mean, after all, why else should you care?
Sure.
This is what matters. So the ability to focus practically is one of this generation's great strengths. And you find this throughout all the time with generations, that you take a strength, turn around, it becomes a weakness.
So now let's look at what we've got here. So we've talked about the boomer generation that people relate to. The term for that throughout history that you're using is you're calling them prophets.
Uh-huh. Prophet archetype, yeah.
Prophet archetype. And then you've got them followed by nomads.
Nomads.
The reason you call them nomads is
to be self-sufficient.
Yeah, you've got to be.
And they are the children of the second turning, or history's summer.
Right.
They enter young adulthood during the third turning, history's autumn.
When things are unraveling.
Which is now.
Right.
It's a time of rampant individualism and a very weak institutional life. They then enter midlife during these fourth turning times
crisis.
Of crisis, when we have to focus on what's on the exam.
Right. And do the pragmatic things
nation,
to keep society moving.
To survive as a society,
right.
Yes. And then they enter old age during the next spring, which
right.
means that they are the ones who become the conservative social force to preside over a very stable society. It's actually the fulfillment of their life to preside over this next
almost.
Golden age,
right.
to see younger generations have the security they felt they were denied as children.
And just to add the historical highlight here, because we talked about FDR and Abraham Lincoln, you look at this generation back in the previous crises, and you find, we're talking about on-scenes managers, the pragmatists, the realists, you find the George Pattons and the Omar Bradleys, the Ulysses Grants and the Jeb Stuarts, Francis Marions and the Swamp Foxes and the Daniel Morgans of the American Revolution. You find the pragmatic, sometimes hard-bitten, but often very effective midlife managers of a time when America needs top quality managerial leadership.
And then they become the general presidents during the
In every case, yes, exactly.
Springtime, you have General Washington,
right.
General Grant,
right.
General Eisenhower. These are nomad presidents.
Right.
These are Gen Xers in our past.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, these people, as we said, are now going to want their children to have what they didn't have, like all generations.
Yeah.
And so
more
they didn't
protection.
Have, right.
And
so,
you see that in schools right now. The Gen X parents are very, very careful about their children in ways they know their own parents weren't.
And also the boomers have some guilt about the way they raise their children. So they're also, as the leaders of society, are becoming the leaders, the power of society, passing laws that are impacting the child's life.
Well, the main ones
that.
Who felt guilty were the silent generation. Again,
oh, really?
They were
okay.
the ones who divorced while they were still children, whereas the boomer more likely experience was to have serial sex before having
so
the
now,
family.
Now it's out of the system.
Right. So, well,
right, exactly.
Not true in all cases, as we well know.
We're going into a political discussion right now.
But what you see with boomers is a really quite guiltless desire to uphold very high standards among
that's
children.
That's the reason, I see.
And there is
even
a
though they didn't have those standards for themselves.
Correct, because they perceive that it is right for now.
Right.
And they are
and that
right.
always happens, right?
That always happens, because now is a different time to raise a child. We're now talking about after the awakening. Raising a child after the awakening, you're dealing with the culture and the movies and the CDs and the nature
violence
of the news
and
violence as opposed to raising a child after a great war, which
in
is a
50s,
time of cornucopia.
Right. Yes, right.
And it
going out and smoking was a big negative,
yeah.
Heavy-duty
well,
deal.
Earlier we talked about the Lost Generation and the GIs as kids back around the turn of the century. And the GI upbringing, GI generation, today's senior citizens, as kids, grew up at a time when childhood was becoming increasingly protective. The hand of parenting, the hand of the law was becoming increasingly protective toward kids. It's important to remember what the Lost Generation had right before them. This was a time when drugs were totally unregulated, a time when there were Coca-Cola had the real thing still, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was a time when parents generally didn't care what kids were doing on their free time, and kids enjoyed a free-for-all child economy with the Nickelodeons.
There were lots of kids back then.
Yeah.
That's what people
exactly.
understand, that this is not the first time that a generation's been raised
exactly.
this way, that it happens about every 80 years as the cycle gets
so the rhythm, all those street news hawkers that we see in old movies, this was the last
cigar rollers, right.
Yeah. Right.
We had George Burns, you know, it was a kid actually played music for people who threw in pennies in saloons. It's amazing you go back to the Lost Generation and find out what they actually did as kids. But our point is, in terms of the season and in terms of childhood, spring is a time when our relationship to our child raising becomes increasingly indulgent.
Right.
The elders seem very wooden, very institutionally, very wed to institutions. We want more individuality from kids. We want to encourage it.
So that's why the boomers were indulgent.
That's why the boomers were indulgent. By the end of the boomer upbringing, we had shows like Art Linkletter's. You know, kids say the darndest things. We're trying to get kids out there to sort of liven them up a little bit.
Right.
Throughout the Xers, you had basically the indulgence had run its course, and you had a very open style of nurture, very underprotected. Okay, with millennials today, and with the hero
millennials we call heroes,
with the hero archetype in generally. Their childhood is defined as a time of increasing protection.
Yeah, let's get back to
that
model.
That's really important
because we've talked about the
prophets,
the life cycle of the prophet fitting the seasons of history. We've talked about the life cycle of the nomad being one step later, so they have
and still
their,
playing a very important role.
But, yes, every generation does. Now let's talk about the hero archetype, which is what Neil described as the millennials. They are the children who are born after that second turning time. They follow the bad generation, quote unquote. And I say that only because it's the reputation, not because it's deserved.
What years are these children born, first of all?
The millennial generation is born 1982 and after.
Okay.
You think of the high school class of 2000.
Right.
As being the leading edge.
How have they been raised differently, and how is that going to affect their thought process?
Well, just think about how they were first born when we saw that baby on board sign.
Right.
The first minivans, the first child safety movements. Suddenly the movies went away from depicting children as evil to depicting them as very good. And you had a lot of celebrity pregnancies. Boomers in their late 30s back in 1982 were suddenly giving birth.
And you suddenly, too, had a lot of books and magazine articles about how badly we treated kids during the 60s and 70s. We got to do better by kids today.
Right.
The child abuse hysteria, the first big panic occurred in the early 80s, just when these babies were coming along. And as Bill said, the media just totally came about face. Suddenly, babies were cute and wonderful, and everyone wanted to reach out and hug them.
As opposed to being aborted.
Exactly. As opposed to being monsters, you know.
What are you doing? What are you doing breastfeeding in the middle of this restaurant? Now it's like, whoop them out.
but then you look at the babies in the early to middle 80s, and you see the same thing with small children around 1990. And you see what politicians were doing. The ads that showed babies in the middle 80s were suddenly showing little kids.
And right about 1990,
for the first time,
you began to see uniforms on elementary school kids.
And you're hearing there's a movement of that right now.
Well, it's growing. Now it's the majority of inner city schools are now uniformed, and increasingly it's moving into the suburbs and exurbs. But we see what we see happening is not just that we see, I mean, uniform, I bring that up because it's so visible, and people notice it around
kids.
It's a symbol, but it also reflects the way these kids are being raised in the classroom, which is team grading, a collaborative learning, The use of cooperative movements increasingly to teach things, a movement back to basics and standards, which is basically the what we want from these kids is to raise the standard and encourage these kids to do better than the kids before them. And I think there's a strong movement at both at the state and federal level.
You look at the shifting attitudes of parenting, and you can see that in a couple of fun examples. You remember the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where you had Richard Dreyfuss going off to an alien spaceship, leaving his kids, right? And it was considered okay.
Right.
Well, we were still in the second turning. Steven Spielberg today says he would not use that ending.
That's interesting. Right.
That he would not have a parent leaving a family to go off and discover himself with an alien culture.
That's interesting.
And Matt,
it's a different time.
Matt Groening, the developer of the Bart Simpson show, now has two small children, and he says he doesn't like his kids to watch his show. That he doesn't think his show is appropriate for those little kids.
And he's an Xer, right?
Right. He's right, I believe, your age, right around the
cusp,
X.
Right.
But basically, we're moving from Xer to millennial kids.
But even in the Bart Simpson show, you look at the younger sibling, and she's smarter and better behaved.
That's true.
Right now in our society, we see the cultural depictions of smaller children as being more virtuous and even smarter than Gen Xers.
So they're actually being taught to have an identity for themselves that makes them the next hero, basically.
Yeah. I went to a junior high school recently, and they had two Gen X teachers and a librarian, and I asked them how many of the kids thought that their teacher and librarian had was part of a generation that had a good reputation, and nobody raised their hand. They all raised their hand when I said, how many think it's a bad reputation? Then I asked them about their own reputation, and they all raised their hand saying that they had a good reputation. But you look at the seasons of history. They are the children of the autumn.
Right.
Just as the GI generation was. Their personal springs are in the society's autumns. That means that they will come of age. They will have their personal summers during society's winter of the fourth turning.
Make sure everybody realizes that. So the fourth turning is the crisis time, usually an economic crisis and very often followed by a war.
These are the soldiers of the next war.
Right. These are the ones that have to go out and fight the war and see how we reorganize society as we know it.
And we will consider them our finest. Elder boomers will consider them the instrumentalities of their elder visions.
In other words, as the boomers get older, they're going to be looking for what's my legacy, and they're not going to find it in the X generation kids gave birth to. They're going to find it in the grandkids.
We will see better voting behavior. We'll see much more team playing performance. We won't see as interesting a culture. We're not talking about bringing the 60s back. We're talking about bringing more of the 30s back.
But it's like, how do you go from a society that has got, as we said, we've gone from Beaver Cleaver to Bart Simpson or more extreme?
This is how you clean up the culture, too. There, obviously, a fourth turning is a time that poses some real perils.
Sure.
But we will be proud of youth, and we will see the culture get cleaned up.
That's fascinating.
And we will see much more of a sense of community, and we will see better manners among all age groups, but it'll be driven by these kids. They will not rebel in the way we are used to thinking about youth rebellion.
I should say, too, that they will take that good kid reputation, and they'll keep that throughout the rest of their lives.
They'll become the new senior citizens.
Exactly. They will be a straight arrow generation that will believe that whatever they do is in the civic best interest of society as a whole. And sometime, further into the next century, their own kids will rebel against institutions grown stale under their heavy hand.
They will have their own autumn of life in history's spring. They will be the institution builders of the next golden age, assuming the fourth turning turns out well.
Right.
And you think of what the GI generation did in the 1950s. These kids will do that in some future era,
as they enter that third stage of their life, they'll be running things. They'll run it the way they won the war, and everything will be strong institution.
They'll run it big with science.
It'll be wonderful. And then their kids, who will grow up in a really wonderful way with protection, they're going to nail them and say, you got no culture, you got no heart, you got no soul, you're not being fair.
That's right. You see, the boomers are raising children who will raise children that will be like boomers.
Right.
In response, the millennials in midlife will insist that no one can be a hero like they can, not even their kids. And like John Glenn or John Wayne, you remember, in Vietnam, these will be aging midlifers who still think they can be better heroes than their kids. And they'll still be doing heroic things, and their kids will be aghast at this kind of behavior.
Let's talk about that, because the generation that follows them you call artists.
Right.
And that's a generation now that will literally, they will come in birth, or they'll have their childhood during wars, the fourth financial turning, war,
during this time
the
of trial,
time. Huge
the winter.
Trial.
Now remember
from,
that
from about say the year 2002 to maybe the early 2020s, and they will be the equivalent of the Silent Generation, who were the children of the Great Depression and World War II.
During this period, childhood is most protective. So it's the opposite of the excerpts,
nomads,
opposite of the nomads, and this is when society is very protective, and they're also aware as kids that adults, older people, are going out and making huge sacrifices on their behalf. You know, keep quiet. It's like Spanky and Alfalfa and her gang, or like, and kids are depicted in much of the opposite again of the ways of Exers, like Shirley Temple. They're wonderful little kids. Yeah. They're perfect. You just not only you want to hug them, you just want to keep them locked in a room somewhere so they'll be safe.
Sweet
throughout. Yeah, yes. Very sweet and almost sacred.
And the protections of the child's world are still there, but they don't have the same connection with the original reason. For example, right now we know why we're putting kids in uniforms. It's so they don't kill each other over clothes, and so we don't have this same kind of self-orientation, and they get back to the task of learning. Well, go one generation beyond, and oh my gosh, we're still in uniforms. We're just automatons in uniforms.
Or we have these long after-school classes. We have year-round schooling. I mean, by then, they'll always be behind cyclone fences. They'll always be in the minivans. By then, we'll lose. It'll just seem like a very easy and convenient way to deal with these kids, right? Just lock them up and keep them out of the way.
But the interesting thing is also that as they come of age in that 21 to 41, they'll be coming of age during springtime, when everything's wonderful, so they'll have no real challenge to face. They won't have a war to fight.
They'll step into a conformist society, right, where they will, and not having been the heroes, they will emulate the heroes as the
silent good, nice people, and they'll do what they're told for the most part.
We've seen this pattern throughout America.
The George Bush generation, is it not?
Bush had World War II.
Oh, that's true.
Michael Dukakis more than
Michael Dukakis.
You put on the helmet, and it doesn't quite fit.
That's right.
And they will always, really not the hero.
Not the hero.
They will
That's
always feel throughout their life a sense of lack of catharsis. A sense that history did not give them the slingshot that it gave the generation just before them, and it didn't give them either the release of the generation coming after them, which will be another...
Yeah. Well, they also are going to be looked at with high expectations by their hero parents because they went out and fought the war. What's the matter with you? Yeah. I assume that that's going to have high expectation but low reward, basically.
They will be looked at as smart but not tough enough. You see, the millennials will come of age in the crucible of crisis if this rhythm continues, and they will feel tough. They will feel hardened by history, with a purpose and with a hubris, whereas the next silent generation will not have that. Yes. The artist archetype.
Let's take a look at this for a moment, because this really helped me understand these archetypes. Is in the stories of mankind, you see lessons in history, obviously mythology. For a story to be risen to the level of mythology, I think is the description you would give. It has to be teaching certain lessons that have been true of virtually any century, any time period. And so the story of the hero, which is the one that's told in every culture known to man and always has been, there are two stories of heroes, and they relate really strongly to the relationships you've described here. The constellation of what stage you are during a crisis. Like we know, for example, that the heroes are always the 20 to 40 range, right? They're in that young adulthood.
Well, you do have
the
myths of the bad old hero kings who were attacked by the visionary young
people. Well, that's the awakening. But let's talk about the traditional hero.
The traditional myth is the old wizard and often a middle-aged nomad.
Right.
Helping the young hero. And one of the exciting things about a fourth turning, the positive messages here, is that it gives us an opportunity to relive the myths of our ancestors, that there is something really very important around the corner in history. It's not all going to be Clinton, Lewinsky, OJ trials, things like this. That we will have a real opportunity, all generations then alive, boomers in old age, Xers in midlife, millennials coming of age as adults, to grab hold of history and with the technology that we have now, which is both great and terrible, to find some way of creating the next golden age, the next springtime of history that will follow.
The easiest way to think about this is just think of Star Wars. Right? Mm. Think of the lineup between Luke Skywalker, who's the young hero.
Right.
Han Solo, who's
nomad.
Obviously the nomad.
Yeah,
right?
Because he's out. You know, he doesn't care about it.
Yeah, don't tell me about the Force or anything like that. You know, lightsabers is all I trust.
The wizard, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and the bad one.
Kenobi, both the good and the bad father figures who are both, though, spiritual. They work through spiritual influence. They understand the Force. They understand all the things that you can't see.
You notice all the movies the last couple of years that have been about fourth turnings,
yes,
that have yearned
going
for
back
them,
to the World War II.
And you usually see some great coming together. The asteroid is hitting, or the insects are coming, or
right.
And something great is happening with our whole society, unifying it,
right.
And you see the generations lining up in
right.
that.
Right.
And this yearning right now is in itself the parent of the ultimate outcome, because as we want this and we express our yearnings for this, sometime history will toss out a spark, whether it's
a
terrorist attack or who knows what, and we will react in a way that's a little bit like these movies.
Absolutely. And the fourth turning is survival. It all becomes really basic.
I think we need to come back, though, for a second and really paint, when are we going to start to experience that, and what's going to start to trigger it for us?
Measured using, you know, where the generational birth years are today and the distance from the last fourth turning, we think it's going to arrive sometime in the middle of the next decade, that is to say 2005, 2006, something around there. It could be a few years earlier or later.
Because I want to make a point about that. Some winters come early.
Some winters
come a bit late.
Early, some come
and
a bit late.
Some winters
late.
Can
long,
be mild and some can be severe.
Right.
But they always come. And you never go from fall or unraveling straight to springtime like
no,
people are trying
don't.
To picture.
And
it just doesn't
not
happen.
Ever.
It will last 20, 21, 22 years, about the length of a generation, as all turnings do. It will be a period at which, sometime during that 20-year period, America will feel as though its survival is at stake in a way which we don't in other periods of our history.
Right.
It will be a time at which economic, political institutions are rebuilt from the ground up. We will rethink things through from scratch in a way which we don't in other periods of our history. History will move rapidly in a sense that we feel it doesn't today.
Right.
In important things, not celebrity, not pop culture events, but things that will be vitally important to everyone.
The risk of war will be high, and the risk that any war will become a total war will be high. This is a time when we will seek to destroy an enemy, and where an enemy may seek to destroy us. It's a time really when not just America but other societies around the world will be experiencing the same kind of generational rhythms, whether it's China or other Asian societies or Israel or Europe. A lot of societies have boomer generations and Xer generations and
because
millennial generations.
Because of World War II. They have the
yeah, because World War II was such a defining moment for them, so we can see this not just as an American moment but global. It will probably have some national elements. You can see an end game to the culture war here. You could see a secessionist movement springing up with surprising speed. Something that today we might laugh off would become really serious. Empires change. This is when the whole power relationship of the world is different. Right now, the United States is the only superpower. Coming out of this fourth turning, who knows what there would be.
That's interesting. Well, then we look at the times in American history, at least. The Revolution was a fourth turning, I assume.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Civil War, 80 years later, roughly, was
yes.
the next one. And 80 years later for us is World War II.
Yeah.
And 80 years later for us here would be around 2020.
Well,
and I guess
between 25 and 2025 in there, yeah. And
yeah.
each time the technology of destruction is ratcheted up. Now we have terrible nuclear weapons in more hands. We have biochemical weapons that are far worse than anything anybody had before. We have the capacity for cyber warfare. A lot of different things that go into the equation this time.
It's useful to remember, Tony, that during the Civil War, if either side had been able to invent something like an A-bomb, they obviously would have used it. The passions were so high, the sense of survival, the loss of life that are already incurred was so great. In World War II, we were at such a war of survival with such great consequences for the destiny of the world that we enlisted our best scientists to invent one, and we used it.
And we felt very morally justified in doing
it. And we felt justified at the time at doing so in a way which we wouldn't later on. And it's important to keep that in mind entering the next fourth turning, because the next fourth turning, we will want to be very careful not to do something that we will regret later or might cause great devastation. So it's a dangerous time, but it's also a time of great opportunity. Because if the danger can be avoided, it also gives society the opportunity to solve big problems,
right.
to rebuild the infrastructure from scratch, for instance.
You want to solve the problem of global weapons proliferation, this is how. You want to solve the global atmosphere problem, this is how. You don't do it in eras like now.
Because you can't get coalitions
exactly.
And unraveling.
People
no one
feel
agrees.
Prepared to sacrifice. You can't get coalition. This is when
you
people come
them.
To.
Right.
It's almost like we need an outer enemy for us to unify something outside of ourselves that's large enough to get people
yes.
to work together.
And it's typically, because of the generational types involved, it's typically going into a fourth turning where if history doesn't present us with such an enemy, we create one. And that's a very
right.
important point because people will say, well, wait a second, you know, who could have predicted when the Japanese would hit Pearl
yeah.
Harbor? I mean, how can that be related to any generational cycle? And our point is always that what catalyzes a fourth turning is not so much the event itself, it's how that event, what that event means to us
as a nation.
The mood
of the country, how we interpret it.
Exactly. I mean, remember that the American Revolution was catalyzed by people going aboard a ship in Boston Harbor and throwing overboard a bunch of tea because it had an extra half penny tax on it. Now, that doesn't seem like an event that would precipitate the founding of a new country.
Right.
But it was, because at that time, every generation alive was at the razor edge, a trigger edge, ready to respond if one more indignity were suffered, if one more insult by Britain had been made to the United
right.
States. Britain had committed many greater insults in the previous years, but at that time we were ready.
In Pearl Harbor, we were ready to go.
Right.
Civil War, ready to go.
How about World War I?
World War I, not ready to go. You look at the sinking of the Lusitania.
Right, because we were attacked in that case.
We were attacked.
And the Zimmerman telegram, we almost had evidence that Germany and Mexico were lining up. We had abundant reasons for going to war.
But it took us a year, didn't it?
Exactly.
And it took us a day in Pearl Harbor.
Right. Yeah, yeah. But think about the fourth turning this way. Suppose there is a terrorist incident against some American community. Right now, we would send a fleet and we would send a few over the horizon Maverick missiles, making sure that none of our servicemen get hurt and probably nobody at the other end gets hurt either. And then we would have anguishing hearings, and then we would wonder whether our pilots put the wrong slogans on the front of their aircraft and all of that. Which is what we did this last time.
Which, by the way, I want to point out, when you look at the histories of wars, depending upon what season it is, you have a different war. When it's a war
yes.
and awakening, Vietnam has happened many times where the youth say, we won't go. It wasn't the first time, because prophets, when they're in their youth,
yeah.
won't go.
Where
but later on, they start a war where they send all the kids to
That's
go.
That's right. Boomers will feel very, very morally justified in sending the millennial generation off to war. And they will risk the lives of the millennials more than Gen Xers are being risked now by the elder silent generals. And the millennials will step forward as dutiful soldiers.
Right.
So if there is a war against terrorists or against some other foreign nation, we will try to destroy that enemy.
People sometimes will ask me, well, name an event which could trigger a fourth turning, which in another turning wouldn't do much. A good example would be Oklahoma City, okay? A bombing of that magnitude, a real crisis, which, you know, we lament, we commemorate the tragedy, we try to do what we can to avoid it happening. Life goes on in our current 1990s third turning. But that's the kind of event which, when we're going into a fourth turning, could, not in itself, but could trigger governmental or public responses, which could trigger more responses by either domestic groups or
yeah.
foreign powers, which leads to a cascade, almost like firecrackers setting each other
yeah.
off.
Whereas right now we provide counseling and we have an extremely expensive trial of one person.
We haven't changed the freedoms or the institutions. So
exactly.
when you look at what could trigger this on extremes, you know, one of those scenarios obviously is, you know, a terrorist now could pollute the water of all
yeah,
New
an
York
anthrax
or blow
attack.
Up a building, an anthrax attack. And so
yeah.
all of a sudden now the same internet, because this brings up a question I wanted to have for you, which is, well, can't a fourth turning be avoided, especially now with technology? Haven't we, you know, when you think in a linear state, you know, in the arrogance of our society, we
yeah.
think, oh, we can beat the seasons. Winter isn't going to come
for us.
They
felt that in the 19-teens and 20s as well. They felt that technology was moving very, very swiftly. It was individuated technologies, automobiles, radio. A lot of things felt very new then. Even more things and feel new now. And what happens when the mood changes is that the use of that technology changes. Suppose there is an anthrax attack against a major American city, and suppose there's a sense that the internet is being used by the terrorists to assemble information. You could very quickly imagine some laws that would empower the government to use the servers to peer into people's computers, to get warrants, to create some aspect of martial law that would apply to the internet. And you would see the very kinds of Big Brother problems that originally when we invented the PCs at the start of the third turning, we thought we would never, ever see. You can see the same kind of problem in biogenetic research, the same kinds of research that today might help some people extend their lives or address certain medical needs in the fourth turning could become terrible weapons.
Well, we're already seeing these trends, and it's very interesting that the biogenetic research and the which is so individuating for individuals and couples who want to solve various genetic problems they have, or they want to do something better for their own kids, or they fear certain genetic diseases. Everyone is now beginning to say, well, you know, government's going to have to start stepping in to regulate this. We're going to create nightmares if we allow people to do whatever they want with this kind of technology. People, in many cases, will invite government back in a way they never would have during the 1970s.
Right.
And it's very important to understand that when we look at the aging of generational personalities, we have a key to understand the application of technology in a way which most people who believe that technology is simply exogenously determined on the outside, at random and by accident, doesn't allow you to do. These are the people who will say that, well, we invented the microchip, we invented the personal computer, we invented the fiber optics, and it pushes us this way, pushes us that way as a society, it speeds us up and now slows us down. What we say is that new technologies are invented all the time, but how we apply them, how we give them life shape in our society depends upon what we want from that technology at the time. And computers is an excellent case, because in the 1950s, when we were really beginning to develop computer technology, at first for bombs and for artillery and things like that, and increasingly in the 1960s for space exploration and an abundance of other uses, we only had one paradigm, and that was an A-frame organization with a big mainframe at the top. Everyone filters the information at the top of the mainframe, it gives an answer, and all the information filters back down again.
Right.
That was because of the society we were in. We were in a first turning. That's the way we thought about institutions.
Right.
We were all part of an A-frame society, of an A-frame universe. Then came the consciousness revolution. Coming out of the consciousness revolution, someone had an idea. Well, it was Apple Computer, and very soon it was a lot of other people. My gosh, we could have personal computers, each one individuated, unconnected. Everyone will have their own personal power. And suddenly said, my,
so
what a wonderful, well, what a wonderful idea, right? Yes. But increasingly we take it for granted. This was not a creation of technology. This was the application of
right.
technology to the kind of society we'd become by the early 1980s.
But what we face now, which is different from earlier fourth turnings, is that the risk of these technologies becoming more enduring in their bad applications is more severe.
Let's talk about let's bring this really to practical application in two areas. Well, the first area is finances, which is an area of great security for people. If we're looking at finances, and you're saying around 2005, 2006, we're going to see a shift, and the shift that's going to happen.
Yes.
What's going to make things change economically, at least? What are the likely scenarios? You've got boomers that are aging.
Well, think of the generations again. The generation that will begin dying is the richest in American history, the silent. And there will be some aspect of inherited wealth that will be important, of course. But the boomer investment psychology will change. Boomers during the bull market are feeling, much as they felt with everything else they've ever done, from sex to raising children, that they're the best that there's ever been, and they're the best investors. They've figured it out.
That's
they
right.
really have it going. I imagine the missionaries, the other boomer-like generation of the 20s, felt the same way back then. Well, be careful of what we call the OO decade, especially the years between about 2002 and 2008, because that's when the boomer cohorts will start becoming of IRA withdrawal age, and then ultimately the big cohorts will start reaching the retirement eligibility ages. Their whole investment psychology will shift to a more defensive one.
Right.
The generation behind them, Generation X, doesn't have as much money.
Right.
And they don't have as many benefits. They don't
and
have.
They're not
the
big as big a generation. Money. They're like.
Well, they're big, but they just don't have as much money.
Okay.
And so who is going to buy the boomers' assets when the boomers try to shift into something more secure?
Right.
At the same time, you'll have the rest of the world probably beginning some form of cultural reaction, so the interdependence of the economy won't feel so good. You won't have the same amount of foreign buttressing of the American economy that we
right.
might have come to right now. You'll see some severe means testing. And it'll be probably couched in terms of making money available for the priorities of young adults.
Because that's where the energy needs to go.
Well, you cannot overstate how important the millennial generation coming of age in the middle of the next decade is going to be.
You know, these boomers then will think of themselves, since they won't have the money, they're going to have to change their identity. And they're going to probably be in a position, I think you described, as where suddenly being a sage is the way in
yes,
which you get your identity.
They will be the priest warrior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the priest warrior, that's a great description, right? So in this fourth turning, you've also predicted then, so somewhere between 2005 and 2008-ish is when we would probably see the most significant deflation, meaning money coming out of the market, so to speak, to a certain extent because of conservatism.
You could. And this may be in response to some global event where we ourselves are engaged more in a higher risk way than we have.
Something more important than just our own economics.
Yeah.
As long as we're talking just about demographics, yes. It's important to remember that a lot of the world, particularly the English-speaking world, you have Canada and the United Kingdom and some of Western Europe, have the same demographic profile. That is to say, they will be aging very rapidly in the first decade of the next century. So they're going to be facing all the similar mm-hmm. pressures.
Right.
And why that's important is that we can't run large trade deficits and import capital and do many of the things that we've been able to do in the 1980s, 1970s. The rest of the world won't be a buffer for us.
They won't have those resources.
They won't have those
consuming
resources.
Them themselves.
Exactly.
Let's come to now back to the fourth turning in terms of what do we do? Let's talk about what do we do economically to prepare? What do we do to prepare our children? What do we do to prepare ourselves? Let's talk about the solution here. And maybe at the end of that, let's talk a little bit about what's great about a winter.
There's a lot of good news to our message. And I would say that the good news is partly that, of course, the mood will change. And a lot of things we can't solve at all or seem intractable now will be solvable in this era.
Because there'll be a coalition.
Because we will find teamwork again. And
yes.
we'll find the ability to cooperate. And we will also find authority worth trusting again. Again, looking at our own situation today, of taking the various musical strains or cultural strains around us we see and recasting them in ways in which they will reflect a society which is trying to be optimistic about the future. It's never more necessary to be optimistic than when you're in the middle of a crisis, right?
Sure.
And also reflects the values of people that are trying to work together, trying to
right.
submerge the individuality.
Right.
When you think about a fourth turning coming, it's on the one hand important to enjoy the current environment. There's some things that are possible now in a third turning that may not be as possible, like global travel, like unhindered access to technologies, like a very diverse culture. Enjoy those things, like a bull market. Take advantage
exactly.
of them while they're here because they're not going to be here all the time. We particularly urge people to realize that the second turning is gone, and the worst thing to do is to try to behave like it's 1970.
Right.
I think Bill Clinton has learned the folly of that. If you try to pretend that it's the late 60s, you're just going to get whapped.
And the same rules apply because they don't.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And in planning for a fourth turning, it's first and fundamentally most important to make sure your life makes sense to you. Make sure that your human relations are strong. Your family is your central survival tool. Your community is extremely important. Your personal reputation for integrity, for truth-telling, for loyalty to other people in times of need, for community service, these become important.
Why?
Well, two things become very important in a crisis era. One is your family, because that's the original social support network of all time. It's what's
right.
there when everything else breaks down.
Right.
And another is whether what's left of government at a very basic level will still be tied to you and still be interested in you. In a fourth turning, historically, we always remember why we invented nations. Invented nations is to empower the community, not the globe, not the locality, but the wider community. And, of course, family. These two things will become very important, and they become survival mechanisms.
I don't want to end this, but we need to. I just want to thank you because for me, I hope that people watching and listening have gotten a new perspective on what's possible. But I'll tell you, for me, the psychic value, the emotional value, the spiritual value for me was a section of your book in which you talked about how there's a real purpose for these seasons. And while we may not be able to see them exactly, like people say, well, why does spring come? Well, there's a balancing act in nature. There's a balancing act in humanity.
Mm-hmm. It's how our civilization can endure. Because if we simply had eras like now without end, we would destroy ourselves.
Where would it go? Exactly. And I think you described in nature, you said, if it wasn't for the flood, the winter, If there wasn't the flood, then you don't have the nutrient balance in the soil. If it wasn't for the fire, you wouldn't clear out all the brush and create room for something new. And similarly, if all the same people kept thinking the same way and were in charge forever, there would be no growth to society or humanity. And
that's one of the purposes of death, actually, because it provides a fresh slate, the death of memory, where something new can come along. The fact that our current heroes are dying is thrilling when you realize that it makes possible a new generation of heroes.
Yeah, and they can't do that in the shadow of someone else. So.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to thank you personally, and I just want to ask you, what's the final message that you want to give people? Where are you guys going now, and what's the message that you would deliver to people here about where life is, where we're going? What do you want them to remember?
Well, we'd like people to think beyond themselves, to realize that they really do have a connection with history. And one point that we like to make is that everyone inhabits the center of a personal memory span. And you think about the oldest person who nurtured you, who had influence over you when you were a child, and when that individual was born. And then think about when your youngest child's youngest child, who you will probably know.
Your grandchild.
Yes, your youngest grandchild, when that individual will die. Because these are people who either touched you or you will touch. In my own case, that extends from 1881 to around the year 2104.
Wow.
It's longer than the American nation has been in existence.
That you have a chance to touch.
And these, or are touched by.
Right.
Yes, and these are our own personal moments in history. They span three full cycles, three fourth turnings. The idea that history will ever end is incredibly arrogant. We have to get beyond that. Instead, we see this rich drama continuing to unfold, and we can look forward to our children becoming midlife titans following the next fourth turning, and our grandchildren ultimately spawning another awakening, challenging the elders like we did in the 60s, history going on and on. That, to me, is the most thrilling, because it's exciting to feel not at the end, but in the middle of history.
That's wonderful.
And progress will continue. Material progress, moral progress. We often like to talk about our cycle of seasons as a spiral. Humanity can progress, but it progresses in rhythms like everything else in life, like your breathing, like the unfolding of a flower. We all do it in an exhale and inhale. We don't do it linearly. And that's really the seasonal bottom line of our book.
This session continues on the next CD.
Now, are you still with me? Kind of chilling, isn't it, to think that these guys are able to predict with such precision some of the events that have happened since this interview? And I left out a lot to condense this for you, and obviously you can pick up their book. But I was in Fiji right after 9/11, and I wanted to find out what they thought was happening today. What did this really mean? And so now what I want to do, even though the audio quality may not be as strong, we're in Fiji, and I got them both on the telephone and interviewed them to say, how do the current events, how are you interpreting them in terms of your understanding as to which turning we're in? So even though the quality may not be ideal, I wanted you to be able to listen in on that conversation via telephone between the United States and Fiji about where are we now in the seasons of life. Let's join that session. We just wanted to get kind of an update because everybody has a feeling that we've obviously been in a fall or are unraveling. And one of the obvious things that shows up with the event of 9/11 is the question for people here is, has winter begun?
Tony, the 9/11 has really been instructive, a teaching moment for America, because what it's telling America is basically either the fourth turning has come or it soon will come, and it already, this event can give you a good idea about how America will respond to this new era. And what you see in this nonlinear change is all of these trends we took for granted in America toward individualism, toward openness and toleration and freer markets and globalism and all of this stuff, which particularly the silent generation thinks is really the kind of the crowning achievement of their life cycle, and hence 9/11 for them is, I think, is a particular kind of tragedy. That these things have shifted, that there has been a nonlinear shift, because each one of those things, even high tech, high touch, you know, we saw in 9-1-1, the World Trade Center is being taken down not by Y2K, not by some high-tech device, but by about five or six knives. There's something almost mythic, I think, in how this has totally unsettled our and disoriented us in our sense of where history is going and where our society is going. And our whole purpose in looking into these rhythms is to try to keep us from getting disoriented, to try to anticipate these bends.
Maybe you can share with us, how would we know if this is the beginning of winter? Mm-hmm. And then secondly, if it's towards the end of the fall, how do we know that? What's the difference, and how would we react differently, if at all?
Well, Tony, on our website, we published an essay exactly about that. And in that essay, we listed 10 points that we recommended that people follow. And I can go over those 10 points with you now.
That'd be great.
And actually, as you have watched the events of the past few weeks, you saw a very powerful, apparent fourth-turning mood that has gradually subsided, not totally, but some. And you think back to 1929 and how that fourth-turning mood didn't come all at once either. And so it's still too early to say whether it's the fourth turning. We'll know in a year, perhaps, but it's... I can imagine the same experience would have held after the Boston Tea Party in 1773, and after Lincoln's election in 1860, it was swifter.
I think that if you look at the generations right now, how they've responded to 9-1-1, it's very instructive. I mean, just go down the different generations today. You have the GI generation, now almost all of them octogenarians. We've seen them on CNN.
Let me interrupt you. They don't all know those terms. He's talking about the hero generation, right?
This is the World War II, Great Depression, young adult generation.
Hero.
Today, you know, the senior citizens and the greatest generation, according to Tom Brokaw.
Right.
You see them on CNN, Cap Weinberger, George Shultz. I'm sure that George W. Bush's father is still playing a role. They are probably the least surprised, the least excited. When I talk to my own mother, it's this feeling, oh, yeah, you know, we know what this is about. And their emphasis is on how do we manage this situation. Let's all stay calm and relaxed. The next generation, it's interesting, is the silent generation. These are the children of the Great Depression and World War II.
These are the artists. Everybody.
These are the artist archetype. These are the peers of Colin Powell and Don Rumsfeld. These are the older leaders in America today, people mainly in their 60s, early 70s. As I was explaining before, I think this generation feels an unusual sense of tragedy with this event because it represents a reversal of so much that they've worked for in their lives in terms of greater nuance and sensitivity in America and a greater openness. And suddenly, you know, what's happening? We're all going back toward lockstep community and closeness and intolerance. And it's very important to point out that the silent generation, because they are still in power, because it is not quite late enough, Tony, as you pointed out, they are really exerting a force in the leadership to keep this thing from getting out of hand.
Now notice, for example, some of the people who have been surprising in the way they've tried to narrow rather than broaden the definition of this war, people like Pat Buchanan and Robert Novak and Bud McFarlane, people you would not associate necessarily with dovish attitudes. Again and again, you're seeing the silent generation, people lining up behind Colin Powell, and the boomers lining up around Wolfowitz, and it looks like, at least for the moment, Powell has the upper hand.
Well, also, Bush's pattern in the past, and it isn't a very long past, seems to be to rely a great deal on his advisors, and he's surrounded by many advisors in that generation, Colin Powell being Secretary of State, obviously.
Yes, well, his cabinet is much more silent generation than Clinton's was. That was more boomer, actually.
Yes, which is actually surprising. Because as time goes by, one ordinarily expects a later generational composition to a cabinet. One of the things we have noticed about boomers, and I just want to give it a snapshot of 9-1-1, because I think it would be helpful to sort of put this in place, you know, where we are right now. A pattern that we've noticed with boomers, starting with the Operation Desert Storm, when we suddenly were amazed to hear these reports of anti-war demonstrators suddenly wanting Saddam Hussein to be nuked, right? And it was disorienting at the time. We suddenly have these pictures of boomers really being vindictive. This was a pattern that became more accentuated in the Kosovo intervention, when boomers were 15 to 20 points more likely to advocate armed intervention, even at the risk of casualties, than either Xers or silent. And once again, with this conflict, I just looked at the Washington Post polls that have come out by age. Boomers are nearly 10 percentage points more likely to say that we should have armed intervention, and I think about 98% of them, virtually as close as to 100% as you get. And of those, there's a 10 percentage point lead in the ones who would risk war, that is to say a more generalized conflict, in order to bring the terrorists to justice. This is this values-driven spiritualist dimension of these boomers, which makes it very difficult for them to compromise. You know, when it comes to good and evil, it's hard to compromise.
Through the 1990s, we were moving into a pre-war mentality, mainly because of the boomers' mindset, their trajectory through history, which follows what Arnold Toynbee, the English war historian, called the Long War Cycle. He described it as a cycle of generations through which it is the generation born immediately after one great crisis, which, by the time it enters old age, is inclined to steward its society into the next great gate in history. And the boomers, in many ways, show signs of doing exactly that in their personal behaviors, their moralistic attitudes, their spiritualism, even their choice of automobiles. You look at their midlife preference for SUVs with the dark windows that look like military convoys going down the street, and contrast that with the pink Cadillac convertibles with the tail fins that their post-war parents had. It's almost an opposite attitude.
How are the nomads responding, you know, the X generation responding to 911 differently?
Well, Generation X, we think, is probably the generation most disoriented, feeling most at sea by 911. And the reason is that unlike older generations, they do not recall any time earlier in their lives when people really respected and trusted big institutions and we really cared about who we were as a nation. Even boomers recall that as children growing up, you know, under Eisenhower and Kennedy. Xers don't recall that. Most of them recall nothing before Watergate. So for them, the whole notion of government, meaning actual, you know, governing or leading people, always seemed a joke to them. That the key theme of their young adulthood has been atomizing, being free agents, and making their own way in the economy and in their own social and family lives.
There are a couple of interesting things that have come out of 911 with the Xers. First is they were disproportionately the victims, as well as the ones whose individual acts of bravery are being applauded as heroism, as the new standard of behavior in our society. The young men on the flight over Pennsylvania and, of course, the firemen and the police officers who were overwhelmingly X.
That's interesting.
A lot of the final phone calls that we have read about or even heard broadcast are of Gen Xers talking about love and commitment. There's been a surge towards marriage, and not just in Washington, D.C. and New York, by a generation that felt as though it had moved too far away from commitment and is coming back to a grounding as a result of this.
And as you know, Tony, from looking at these archetypes, that one thing we've always predicted for the nomad archetype in midlife is slowing down. Gen X is just on the cusp of midlife now, and that's what they will do. They will slow down, they will simplify the culture, they're going to become very protective of family life, and a lot of things that already started even before 911. I was very intrigued to see reports of Silicon Valley and all the, you know, cutting-edge elite Xers who work there in the wake of this new, you know, recession for certainly their dot-com industry, how many of them were getting married, and how many of them were sort of settling down in their lives and actually taking advantage of this new window in their lives to sort of get rooted, get settled, and commit themselves. And there's been a tremendous amount of reporting in the wake of 911 about how in the big urban centers, Xers don't want to be alone anymore. In fact, one poll I saw showed that when you ask people, have you actually changed your daily life, that is to say, your rituals of daily living in response to 911, Xers were much more likely to say they had than any other generation.
And they're the ones that produce the balance so that the prophets don't go crazy, yes. besides the silence before them. That's interesting.
Yes. The generation that has perhaps been affected the least to this point, but over its lifetime stands to to gain or lose the most by anything that happens in a fourth turning are the millennials, the teenagers up through today's college sophomores. And when you think about what the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon represented for the adult world, America's teenagers experienced much the same thing in Columbine.
Yes.
That was a terrorist act of sorts in which the security of their daily environment was randomly attacked and turned into an inferno of hell. And it was not just the event. Of course, many fewer people died in that, but it seemed like a tremendous number who died, the 15 altogether, including the two shooters. But you look at the reaction in American schools in the following 6 weeks, and there were tremendous rule changes. There were panics. There were false threats. There were some real threats. The rules changed. We went towards zero tolerance. We had all kinds of technological security enhancements. And the kids were really scared. They overestimated the risk that they faced of just being in schools. There weren't that many school killings, but when Neil and I ask high school audiences how many school killings they think occur each year in America, they way overestimate that.
It seems like it would be a natural process to make them want to work together and care about each other, you know, a stimulus for the very role that they need to play later on.
Yes, that actually takes us to the 10 points. Perhaps we should go over those.
That'd be fantastic. How do we know if we're entering a fourth turning? Is that what this relates to?
Yes, whether we are still in a third turning or entering the fourth. Let me read these points, and after I read each one, maybe Neil could elaborate on the point. Number one, by the way, these are hallmarks of a reaction that would indicate that we are in a fourth turning. If we don't see this or we see backsliding from this, then we're still in a third turning. But even if we are backsliding, it's definitely a precursor of what we can expect to find later. Number one, a desire to describe the problem in maximalist rather than minimalist terms in ways that would sweep other problems, whether fiscal, economic, cultural, or moral, into this one big problem.
Obviously, that has boomer written all over it, right? In other words, to take this one problem, be a sort of a total test of our worth on earth and who we are as a society, and to subordinate all other things to the achievement of that goal.
Point two, a movement toward grand solutions that would permanently solve the problem rather than solutions that could be interpreted as delay or diversion.
Tony, this is very important, and actually this show I was just on, we actually talked about this. One thing that happens in previous fourth turnings is that because everyone is asking now whether, well, we want to really solve the problem, but maybe 6 months from now we'll just be satisfied with Osama bin Laden and a few of his accomplices, and then we'll just call it a day. And people are wondering whether the same sense of mission will continue or not, or whether we'll just sort of slide back to something more diminutive in the sense of our sense of goals. One lesson to remember from real fourth turnings is that not only do we not slide backwards, our sense of mission actually increases. In the Civil War, when the war broke out, it was just a war between the states. We thought it would be settled very quickly. It was not at that time that we actually thought about enacting a bunch of fundamental new constitutional amendments and emancipating slavery instantly. We were thick in the war when we decided to make much broader and more challenging our goals. The same thing with World War II, when we really decided during the war that, no, we would not accept a negotiated surrender. We had to go all the way into Japan, occupy it, have MacArthur there, set up a whole new economy, set up a new constitution. People today talk a lot about root causes. And fourth turnings are often violent ways that people find of really going at root causes and making sure that problems, we don't finesse problems.
You may not even know what the grand solution is you're working toward. And for example, in a fourth turning application of a terrorist war, it could become what some are calling the West versus the rest, with a solution that would alter the relationship between the first and the third world in ways that we cannot understand now. The lesson of past fourth turnings is early, or a couple of years before, let's say, you could see dimly what the gate into the fourth turning would be, just as had we been looking carefully in the 1990s with the bombing of the World Trade Center and the lack of security and just the casual atmosphere and spreading of terrorism and so on. We could have anticipated perhaps an event like Terror Tuesday, but there's no way that we can tell what the grand solution will be now. It's just something that we would find ourselves propelling towards. The third point here is an impulse toward total reaction. In other words, total war, including destruction of enemies, as opposed to calibrated action, which would be legalistic enforcement of rules, justice, or trial for enemies. Think about that as the Wolfowitz versus Colin Powell debate.
Yes, it's very interesting to hear from the silent generation is much more inclined to talk about rights, justice, timetables, coalitions, and talk about the problem as being very complex and requiring a very complex and extended solution, where boomers now are talking about something much more simpler but much more total. That's kind of what we'd expect from these two archetypes.
Interesting.
The fourth point, a distinct shift in public life away from individualism, including civil liberties, and toward community purpose and survival.
Yes. Historically, just keep in mind that suspension of habeas corpus has occurred in the entry to every one of our four turnings. The American Revolution, Abraham Lincoln did it when we went into the Civil War. Basically, you just grab anyone and just hold them, regardless of procedure, because we're in a state of war. And it's very interesting that, and obviously we did that during World War II, and this is the first time in a long time that we've done that.
The fifth point, the end of the petty arguments of the third turning, the blue zone, red zone culture wars rooted in old second turning debates that may begin to feel ridiculous, even dangerous in a new era.
Well, I guess you could say that the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal looks very distant at this point. And Gary Condit. I mean, just think of all the things we've been arguing about. This suddenly seems like not just a couple of years ago, but a couple of decades ago.
Interesting.
Point seven, and this is related. Or actually, we didn't get to point six, but let me do point seven ahead of six because it's on point here. A sharp negative turn in America's perception of immigration and in time of potential immigrants' perceptions of America and of globalism more generally. Recall the old Wired magazine forecast that, quote, open good, closed bad, unquote, was a permanent attitude. Will our society now move towards closed good, open bad? Will we see a move toward nativism in our culture and treatment of foreign-born Americans and toward a sort of do-it-elsewhere-but-not-here isolationism in foreign policy? What will globalism mean now? Will people begin fearing it, not merely as a possible threat to jobs, but for how it might make fanatics out of people halfway around the world? The nativist right could easily join the anarchist anti-IMF left on this one.
Gee, there's so much could be said about this. One thing to keep in mind as an historical pattern is that these nomad generational archetypes, of which Generation X is an example, have always in our history been enormous immigrant generations because they come of age during a time when our borders are wide open and life in America seems very attractive. In every case, when you get to the end of Generation X, the X archetype, and start the next hero generation, our borders close up, life becomes less attractive here, and immigration hugely dries up. That's happened in every case with this transition. And it's going to be very interesting to see if Generation X becomes known as not just a bigger immigrant group than the one before it, than boomers or silent, certainly, but also bigger than the millennial generation coming after that, much in the same way that the lost generation, born just before 1900, was known for being the same kind of peak in immigration.
Realize that as we talked about Generation X providing the heroes and the romantics out of this, that they also are the age that is being rounded up. It
yes.
is immigrant Gen Xers who are being rounded up.
Yes, and of course they've always been incarcerated a lot more than than other generations. That's been part of the fate of Generation X. They were already the most incarcerated young adults in American history per capita.
Why?
This is, you know, part of that reputation problem that's going to unfortunately continue. Another point, just to bring up quickly, is that there's certain sectors of our economy that are being hugely hard hit. Media, advertising, but especially travel and everything having to do with travel and personal mobility. There's a new piece just today on the Wall Street Journal about how parents are now advocating and wanting their kids to go to colleges closer to home. No one wants to travel for vacation anymore. There's this big almost cocooning instinct that's taking place. this is a fourth turning phenomenon, should it continue? And it's going to make us think very differently about our societies being ever more mobile. Again, that's a linear trend that will be broken.
Interesting.
Okay. The increasing irrelevance of the celebrity culture. Will anyone care about Michael Jackson or Michael Jordan in the familiar third turning way? Recall how, once the last fourth turning started, the flagpole sitters came down less because they themselves felt any great new purpose than because the public just stopped paying attention. And here, if I can make a comment, it's instructive to see what happened in America in the years 1929 to 1931, because that was the time that the accelerated high-tech culture of that time, the speculative culture, the celebrity carnival and all that, gave way to something very new. People became friendlier. People settled more. They did as Neil just said. They stayed around their homes. They went to libraries. The culture became less violent. We moved towards the Fred Astaire's. The idea of elegance and gentility returned. There was a much more positive depiction of young people in the culture. And this is something that we've already seen in the last month.
Very true.
Let's go on. We have three more points here. A movement by each generation toward a new archetypal role in keeping with the phase of life it is about to enter. Are boomers overcoming narcissism? Are Gen Xers circling the wagons around family? Are millennials emerging as young heroes? Keep an eye on the media treatment of millennials. Will the criticism start giving way? Will the pop culture change? Will the youth fare be less gross and less violent? Okay, number nine, a new willingness to pay a human price to achieve national purpose. Will military plans resemble Kosovo or Iwo Jima? Will we try to rely on exquisite technologies to reduce the risk of military deaths? Or will we rely on human courage to reduce the risk of technological failure?
Well, here, of course, is a whole new paradigm of sort of military strategy, which absolutely no one is thinking about. Because during the 1980s and 1990s, we kept on thinking of more and more high-tech, about kind of nuanced foreign policy interventions. We talked about asymmetrical conflict when the enemy would be very subtle and hard to identify, and also a society in which all the military planners thought would be very intolerant of significant, if any, casualties. And thus was born the trend toward what was called cruise missile diplomacy during the Clinton years, when if something happened that damaged our interest, we'd do something extremely high-tech with very little sacrifice. I think that the question is, are we now beginning to see that maybe if we want a total solution to some problems, it's going to require not only sacrifice, but huge amounts of manpower? And it's interesting to me, if I can just link this up with another issue that might come up, and that is the whole question of uniform national service for millennials as they grow older. We think that this is probably likely, particularly if the economy gets worse, these kids have trouble finding jobs, and particularly if this war era continues to become more urgent. Suddenly people are talking about, where do we get the personnel to watch all of our reservoirs, to watch tunnels, to watch airports, to watch harbors? And just think about all these things coming together. If these kids don't have jobs, boomer parents will be looking at these teenage kids, their trophy kids, wondering what kind of role they're going to have and how they're going to actually protect the future of America. I think you could see every generation agreeing that it would be a wonderful idea, and including the millennials themselves, if we really almost set this generation up and organize it as a gigantic team. And, of course, if that happened, it would really crystallize their generational differences from all of the older generations today, certainly from Xers and boomers.
Point 10, a shattering of consumer confidence. Is the economy still expected to veer up and avoid a recession, or will we soon see newly dark forecasts about a likely recession or worse? What will happen to the Dow and NASDAQ? With every major global economy sinking even before Tuesday, will there be talk of a perfect storm? As for the direct impact of the event itself, how should we assess the damage to the World Trade Center towers, to the travel and entertainment industries, to America's global reputation for inviolability, and to the immediate household lurch toward consumer caution and liquidity? The longer the upcycle, and it's been a long one, the graver the risk that the trip down could be vertiginous.
I think, obviously, as we point out, if it's a crisis that we already had the whole world kind of moving toward the recessionary direction at the same time. That was already commented on before 9-1-1. If this accentuates that, if this suddenly makes most Americans feel that the uncertainty is going to cause them to pull back from consumer expenditures, further encouraging businesses to wonder about whether they ought to invest in increased capacity, you could have the sort of emergence of not just a little recession, a little, you know, V-shaped recession people like to talk about, but something considerably bigger, something that would match this whole shift in the national mood as they kind of reprioritize what's important. And remember that if we're reprioritizing nationally, for instance, spending much more on infrastructure, less on individual entitlements, this is going to require some sectoral shifts in our economy. People are going to have to, some industries are going to be damaged. Other industries are going to be strengthened. And there will be dislocations in that process, as there was certainly in all of America's previous fourth turnings.
It's interesting to point out, too, that the past four turnings began with an isolationist and nativist and anti-market, even an anti-global power phase, which fostered a rebirth of a national community. But then they began to move back towards a more optimistic and global phase.
Yes, and that I would say is something a little bit anomalous about this fourth turning, and we're going to have to watch that. Most fourth turnings start with America suddenly kind of retrenching and looking inward, and only toward the end of the fourth turning do they look outward toward the world. And it's going to be really interesting to see if we move in a very much a nativist direction. This particularly might happen, for instance, if initial military actions in the Middle East go badly. We have a very bad experience with them, and we suddenly decide, oh, to heck with it. We're not going to solve their problems. We're just going to seal our borders. If that happens, then we're probably in for a couple more years of third turning, and our fourth turning is going to be much more domestic and inward-looking than it would be if it starts out with this kind of military action.
How do we prepare? How do we take advantage of a fourth turning to create a greater quality of life?
Now, in the fourth turning, we had seven guideposts that we offered for individuals to follow, and I'll go over those, and again, Neil, you can expand on them a little bit. The first point is to return to the classic virtues, to try to be known as a person others can count on in a pinch, a person of integrity, loyalty, self-restraint, family support, cultural decency, and honor.
Yes, I think these might seem no-brainers or obvious, but actually, I think during the 1990s, a lot of people wondered whether these things really did matter. I know one of the best sellers in the 1990s, I believe, is a book, I actually haven't read it, although I've read excerpts from it, called Rich Dad, Poor Dad, is that it? It's basically about how if you really want to get be a success in life, you shouldn't worry about all that stuff, about, you know, integrity and perseverance and all that, that those are the people who never get anywhere. You ought to break the rules and do things in a very different way because of the new kind of era we've entered. Again, our message is that the era is going to change in a fundamental respect, and some of those classic virtues could turn out to be a lot more important than we thought in the 90s.
If we didn't periodically, as a civilization, return to where the classic virtues paid off for people, they would have disappeared a long time ago. The second point is, heed emerging community norms. Appearances and reputations will matter, for better or worse, and the nation's core will matter more than its diversity. So don't isolate yourself from community affairs.
This is a hugely important lesson we find for managers and people in business, because a lot of them have spent a lot, certainly the lesson of the last few decades is it doesn't pay to care about politics, about regulations and rules and laws, because all these things are kind of getting weaker every year. The only thing that matters is markets and your competition. What we're saying is that in every fourth turning, suddenly public authority becomes much more important, and it really pays to know who's politically in charge. I mean, these are the people who, in a pinch, will may have enormous powers, both to help you and hurt you if you don't care about who they are and you don't care about what's going on in the public arena.
Third point is to build personal relationships of all kinds, face-to-face contacts with neighbors, bosses, employees, customers, suppliers, creditors, debtors, public officials, and police will become newly important.
Yes, and to know where your money is. The 1990s, as was the 1920s, these were great decades for inventing entirely new forms of wealth that were insubstantial to a degree that was beyond the imagination of Americans at the time. The 1990s, you know, we have all these new derivative products. I mean, my gosh, I mean, you own some of these things. What the heck do I own? You know, it's a probability based on a percentage, based on a something that's hidden in some hard drive, squirreled away in some distant city. Our lesson is know where your wealth is. Know how it's really accounted for. Know how you can liquidate it. And in that sense, simplify your financial life.
The next point is be a team player. Integrate your skills, works, and pastimes with those of others. Stress less what sets you apart as an individual and more what you have in common with others. Raise your children to excel at teamwork and learn group skills among peers of diverse backgrounds and abilities.
Hopefully, of course, we think that's exactly what we've done with millennials. These are kids that are used to team teaching, team grading, student juries, non-collaborative sports, social recess, I mean, a whole bunch of ways in which community is stressed. Community service and service learning is now becoming a norm in the schools today. The uniformed school child is one of the most conspicuous kind of hallmarks of the millennial in cities today. And so I think that in many ways America can be satisfied that we've certainly moved kids in the right direction.
Well, we have made them less creative and imaginative at the same time. And one of the things that we can reflect on as boomers is how after school, when we played sports, especially in elementary and middle school years, we would play workups, or we would gather a bunch of kids and take what equipment we had and go to some irregularly shaped park and invent some rules and have a game that would follow who knows what path. Whereas now, the kids are schlepped off in minivans, taken to manicured fields with the professional coaches and referees, with leagues with standings, and everything is figured out for them, so they are trained in these team skills, but they're given no opportunity to apply imagination to the task.
Can I just interject one important point here? And this has to do with sort of emerging political attitudes, because this is very important with regard to 911. A lot of boomers and people, you know, the age of myself and Bill, we recall as kids government and states, nation states, being extremely powerful and having enormous power to do horrible things to the world, Dr. Strangelove and On the Beach. And then they had these managed wars like Vietnam, which were highly problematic. And the problem with the world was too much state power, too much conformity.
And we had recently had a Hitler and a Stalin.
Exactly. So we grew up in the shadow of totalitarianism. Now, look at how differently things look from the viewpoint of these millennials growing up. All of the tragedies that have happened in their young lives, whether Oklahoma City, Columbine, Kosovo, and certainly 911, is caused by ineffective government, government that cannot look out and cannot keep tabs on wrongdoers. Huge areas of the world, which are, in a sense, power vacuums in which horribly evil things can spawn and grow. Their concept of the world is going to view state power probably in a much more favorable light in terms of its potential to order things and clean things up than boomers did. And that's the power of looking at life generationally, is to kind of see those things emerging.
But the boomers were specifically raised to resist a big brother. And had there been a book of virtues in the 1950s, it would have read very differently from Bill Bennett's. It would have had things like resisting or questioning authority, imagination, creativity, things that would have not led you to follow an Orwellian future. And, of course, in 1984, there was that most famous ad in the history of advertising, according to some people, the woman jogger who smashed the telescreen with the sledgehammer.
Millennials
are being raised to tolerate a Big Brother intrusion. The use of the internet and biotech and many other technologies for powerful community purpose.
Wow.
The next point is look to your family for support. This will not be a good time to be or feel socially stranded, and your extended family will be your ultimate safety net. If you have no spouse or children, develop an alternative family-like support network among friends, neighbors, and coworkers.
Fourth turnings always see the huge revival of sort of family values as really kind of the bedrock of American life. And it's basically why first turnings, like the American High, which came right after World War II, and other first turnings in our history, usually are kind of the pinnacle or the height of family orientation of everything, is because people have gotten so reconnected with their families again.
And we've never before in the history of polling seen children get along as well as they do with their parents now. The next point, expect public support mechanisms to change beyond recognition. Today's senior benefits could erode as youth, not age, becomes the target of civic action and reward. Prepare for hard choices in old age by reflecting on your basic philosophy about life, death, and the mutual duties of parent and child.
This is really an answer to an old question that many of us budget reformers have been asking for years, even decades. What will it take for the federal government and Congress finally to see legislated some reform of Social Security that might actually limit the benefits being sent to very well-to-do households that are getting back more than they ever paid in? Well, I think the answer is fourth turnings are the things that do that. If America sees millennials actually taking casualties somewhere in the world, they're actually making sacrifices and enduring hardships, boomers who will be entering elderhood will never demand their Social Security benefits over what's necessary to support those kids. Just keep in mind that no one in America at any age group will call boomers in retirement senior citizens. I mean, that phrase will be deep-sixed because of the boomer reputation. And boomers will take much more pride in the influence they have over the culture than in their material reward from government. And in that way, they're going to be very different from the GI generation who parented them.
What will they be known as, sages?
They will be known as sages. They will be known as old Aquarians, gray champions. They will be known as spiritually and culturally deep, with wisdom beyond the imagination of younger people. But they will not be known as powerful people. It's interesting, even in terms of the body look, the difference between George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan, right? Just think of the difference in body language and type. And this is typical, we think, of sort of your typical kind of classic prophet archetype leader, whether it's FDR or Abraham Lincoln and so on. These people are not usually physically imposing, but their words and their values resound, as opposed to heroes as leaders who usually personify a very powerful physical type. Right? When we think of, you know, John Kennedy or Ronald Reagan, we think of, you know, the kind of the men's men idea.
Think about the king versus the prophet or the wizard.
Right. Think of this archetypally, exactly.
Very good.
Okay, the next and final point here, although there's a broader point we can discuss as well. Diversify everything you do. Brace for a total alteration of market conditions. Avoid leveraged investments or long-term debt. Hedge your portfolio. Keep a reliable cash flow. Stay somewhat liquid. And as Neil said before, really know where your money is.
Yes, well, this is just common sense that you can expect to lose things. Things will be lost. Unexpected things will happen. And what you have to do is brace yourself by just making sure that, yeah, I can take a few hits, but I'll still be able to keep sailing. And that's really an important lesson in a fourth turning.
In our book, we describe a fourth turning as something like an extended winter storm, where you need to prepare reasonably, not to panic, but just have some sense of what you would need, who could help you, and why what happens to you would matter to somebody other than yourself. It's a time to move utterly away from narcissism. And a core aspect of the shifting seasons of history is catching the drift early enough so that you're not caught flat-footed. And at root, it's a matter of making sure that your life just makes sense. Whether you have money or you don't, whether you have family or you don't, are you living a life that is going to make sense as we transit from the third to the fourth turning? And that has to do a lot with your inner life, but it also has to do with your relationship with your community.
Very interesting. What can you tell us briefly? I know you've given us a lot of time here. Thank you very much. Just a couple of things we want to touch base with. What about America and a good norm of the world after World War II became aligned in their seasons? Where is the season different? For example, is Japan on the same timeline or a different timeline? Where would we go? Is the southern hemisphere different than the northern hemisphere? If you wanted to go to a different season, is that possible in a world that's so connected?
World War II was the largest generation-creating incident in the history of the world. You had most of the northern hemisphere experiencing this cataclysm, this empire adjustment, at around the same time. Neil and I have not made a careful study of other civilizations, or I should say other countries and so on, but we've noticed that the American cycle is probably a little ahead of most. You have, for example, Japan, a society that did not really enter a first turning. You didn't start to see a baby boom. You didn't start to see the attitude towards community until deep into the 1950s. You look at the European continent, and it appears that they're two, three, four, five years behind us. England may be a little closer.
Is that because of the damage that they went through during the war?
Yes. The first thing to understand is that basically large areas of the world, of the modern world, all of Europe, including Eastern Europe and Russia, all of the English-speaking world, we think, wherever you find it, and most of East Asia, including most notably China, are very much decisively on a similar cycle. That is to say, the older civic generation is now dying off, whether it's the Long March generation of Deng Xiaoping or, all of the patriotic war generation, the resistance generation in Europe. You have a silent generation who came to power. Actually, Jiang Zemin is now in power in China. A much less certain generation. These are the children of war. You have a global boomer generation. The Red Guard generation who came of age during the Cultural Revolution in China, and obviously, Bader-Meinhof and the Red Brigade and all of those groups.
And then Netanyahu's peers in Israel, and of course Tony Blair and Javier Solano.
Exactly.
People who are much more bellicose.
Right. Well, it definitely took a peer of boomers to give a speech like Tony Blair gave about 3 days ago. And then you have a global Generation X, which everywhere in the world, particularly in these countries, is associated with two things, a disinterest in politics and ideology, and an acute interest in economics and making the practical parts of their life work and fit together, that is to say, opportunities, and a great deal of attraction to mobility in order to give themselves opportunity. These are hallmark Generation X traits everywhere in the world. Now, the actual timing of each of these is slightly different, and as Bill mentioned, we think the United States is slightly ahead of other countries, but China is an interesting example, and actually that was the first translation of the fourth turning was into Chinese, and they actually beginning to number their generations, starting with Mao Zedong.
Wow.
Numbering them really according almost exactly to our schema. So China is very much aware of that, and the question of course this raises is, what does it mean for our future confrontations to the world? At least that's one question, to the extent that we may be pitting similar archetypes against each other.
Interesting.
Now, it's curious, in the Islamic world, those countries are not necessarily on the same rhythm because they had a different experience.
You took my next question. Where is the Islamic world? The Islamic world obviously varies, but where are they in their seasons?
The Islamic culture has seen this pattern in its own society. As we leave talking about Asia, we should mention the mandala, which is a classic Asian notion of the quaternity of time, the squared circle. And in Islamic culture, the medieval philosopher Ibn Khaldun wrote about the four-generation dynasty, where you begin with a dynastic element that is strong and confident. By the time you get to the fourth generation, it has become so weakened and corrupted that a new king emerges, either from within the old group or else conquers it. And if you look right now at the Islamic world, and you try to see in which age bracket the dark wizards are, I say dark in terms of pessimistic or brooding, and which age bracket the heroes are, young and old, look at Afghanistan. You've got this old king in his 80s, bin Laden is in his late 40s, and that's nothing if not a priest warrior, and you have these... you could call them in their own context the hero kids, the kids who are prepared to give up everything for a collective purpose, who are in these camps.
Very interesting to see interviews of bin Laden, because obviously there's been a huge media focus on this man. And what's really striking about the interviews is his total rejection of materialism, and how he teaches in his camps these young people who he regards as sort of active extensions of his will. He teaches them the unimportance of life, the unimportance of pleasure, how everything important is on a dimension in which material things are irrelevant. And all of it is at least suffused in this faith-based rhetoric. Well, this is a profoundly evil man. And I think you can see in this, though, certain elements of a philosophy or an approach to life that has that has a certain appeal to a lot of those of us in our 40s and 50s who wonder if we haven't sold our soul, who wonder if civilization is really in accordance with our deepest values. And I find this actually interesting to see how this plays out in the news when people sort of respond to the whole idea of Islamic fundamentalism, how the universities are responding to it, you know, because obviously when it comes to fundamentalism here in America, they usually very much dislike it. And yet they're trying to lean over backwards in another way, say, we really ought to listen to what these fundamentalists are saying in Islam. But I find that the twists and turns here and the ironies are extremely interesting.
The whole teaching that they had, if you read the letter that they found in the attacker's luggage that wasn't transferred on the plane, was all about that this is no longer a time for pleasure, that this is the ultimate time for sacrifice to be significant, that exact same message that you're talking about.
Well, that language was practically scripted by bin Laden, and it's really kind of suffused all of his cells. And these kids, they go along with it. They say, okay, you know, yes, sir, you know.
Well, it's curious that if you look at it archetypally, he's got the mass developing under him, the teenagers, and you have the nomads who have been the Muhammad Attas, the 30 to 35-year-olds, who have been the ones who have played the game of the global culture, the open borders, the forged documents, the Luke Skywalker, if you will, to the Darth Vader, if I can slightly mix the Star Wars metaphors, but the idea of the young adult nomads, the young mass coming underneath, and the aging prophet is classic to myth. It's happened throughout human history, and we see it replaying here.
Tony, I don't know how much you've told them about myth and how we use myth as an archetypal way of understanding historical eras, but one thing we certainly discuss at some length in the Fourth Turning is how these myths, classic myths in history, whenever they show the young hero, the valorous young hero, who's about to found a new kingdom or you know, slay a dragon, the older figure is always a figure of extreme wisdom. And there's always a matching of these two. And when the young person is wise and the young person has insights that older people don't have, the older person that they're paired with in myth is always a powerful person, right? It's a Pontius Pilate type. It's a King Vortigern. With a young Merlin. It's someone with power and a very secular view of life. And here you see the young prophet and the old hero versus the young hero and the old prophet. You're basically seeing these same generations in different phases of life. And I think it's fascinating to look at myth in terms of generational archetype.
The experience of legend is what establishes these stories as myth. And it generates the yearning for each of these generations to complete its life story. And that brings us actually to the final point, and that is that whether we are in a fourth turning yet or not, this is the yearning, this is the pattern that we are part of, and it's not a brief thing. It's something that we can expect to last about the length of a generation, about the next 20 years or so. You can't set a clock to it. And you think right now of these teenagers in the Islamic camps, the Taliban and other camps. One of them I recall being quoted as saying that that you Americans or Americans of our age believe in Pepsi-Cola, whereas we believe in death. And you think of that, and you realize these people in 10 years will be in their mid-20s. And in 20 years they'll be in their mid-30s. And people like bin Laden, these spiritualists who are 50-ish now, they're going to have another 20 years of powerful influence on their society. That the George Bush, Wolfowitz, Hillary Clinton, Steven Spielberg, Bill Bennett, you name it, these are people who are not eclipsing in power now. They still have a ways to go before they reach their apogee.
Last question for you, if we may. What do you tell your kids? I know you have a group of kids so that they are inspired about what's coming and not depressed about it. What's the message that you want people to hear if you're speaking to, you know, across the entire United States and everyone is hearing your voice right now and they've just experienced 911 and they have this sense of loss of control? What primary message do you give your kids or someone who's in that depressed state so they have something really to look forward to, understand that this is a unique and important opportunity in their life and in their history?
I have a teenage daughter who is a high school senior, and she of course, has heard me talk about this a lot and heard Neil talk, and she's aware of all of this. And she just yesterday had an op-ed piece published in the Washington Post that expressed her feelings about what was going on and the fearfulness and the worry, the sense that the future was always going to be something bright, and now they don't know, and there's this anxiety about a future war and a war of a dimension they can't understand, and they can't see an easy way out. If our response is too weak, we could have more terrorism. If our response is too strong, we could have a wider war. And in her last paragraph of her essay, she said that the one thing that gives her personal comfort and a sense of hope is realizing that the same kind of fear and worry and sense of being startled that today's teenagers feel is what the GI generation, what Brokaw calls the greatest generation, experienced in the 1930s, and that they went through a period of anxiety and fear and joblessness, but then muscled up and became the greatest generation of soldiers in the history of the world. And they emerged from World War II in a shining new modern world that had elevated the level of civilization in many ways. And then you look at all they accomplished with landing a man on the moon and with science and infrastructure and many, many things, all the way down to the Disney worlds. They achieved a lot, and she said in her last sentence there that we teenagers today are worried, we're scared, but we're also ready to be part of the next great generation. And there is this determination that you see in teenagers, which is tremendously admirable. Neil and I tell everybody who will listen to us that perhaps the most important thing we can do in America right now is to think well of our kids, because they will inhabit the 21st century in the same way that this GI generation inhabited the 20th. A fourth turning doesn't have to be a terrible time. It can be an exhilarating time in which we solve a lot of problems that previously felt insoluble. And it is the core optimism and civic spirit of these kids that is going to get us through as a society.
Yes, I don't have much to add to that except simply to say that in talking to a number of journalists who've been visiting schools, and I've been kind of curious to get their reactions because, of course, everyone is interviewing kids today. And a lot of these journalists, the last time they often interviewed kids was maybe back in the late 1980s, and they were expecting Gen X kids. They expected a very kind of impulsive attitudinal response, maybe not terribly well thought out, and the impulse toward, you know, one-day wonder wars of the kinds we associate with Gen X, you know, Grenada, Panama, you know, Desert Storm, quickly over, just go in and nuke them or do whatever and come out. And also just an attitude that people associate with Generation X about doing something well, but doing it very simply and getting out. Everyone was amazed at how these kids did not show any of that attitude. They were thoughtful, reflective, serious. They were very collegial among each other when they spoke in a group. They were very interested in each other's opinions. This generation of kids is planning way out ahead, 10-year, 15-year plans they have in their lives in terms of their careers and college and so on. And their kind of sober assessment of the pros and cons and certainly a desire not to take too many risks, I think is something that has really impressed everyone and should really be an inspiration to all of us.
It is a way that history works in compensations. You look at the 1920s and what kind of a decade that was, and how the kids that were growing up then, by the time they got into young adulthood, they were about as far from what the 1920s represented as you could imagine. Well, the same thing, of course, was true of boomers in the late 60s and 70s, if you think about their childhood of the 1950s. And if anybody had tried to anticipate what boomers were going to be like by looking at the teen culture of the early 60s with all the beach party movies and the Pat Boone songs and so on, you would have not made any sense. You would have made no accurate forecasts. And the same thing is true for millennials. When you look at movies like American Pie and South Park and TV shows like Boston Public and Eminem and all of this stuff, that says nothing about them. And I would encourage everybody who's there who have millennial children particularly to realize that this is a whole generation of kids like their kids. and their kids' friends. And it's a very powerful group, and one in which our country should take enormous pride. We may have to see them face some sacrifices in this coming time, and it may not be a simple path to peace and prosperity. But when they get there, they could lift our entire civilization up to a plane that is unimaginable today, and something that we could, if we are fortunate enough to see it in very old age, we can be very, very proud in what they'll accomplish.
You have been so generous with your time. Is there a greater interest in what you're doing now? Is there a massive interest or a spark of interest? What's happened, just out of curiosity?
Yes, there's obviously been a huge interest. It's interesting, Fourth Turning, which is obviously of all of our four books that we've written together, the one that focuses most on this whole question of rhythms of history as opposed to just generations. Sales of that book have huge peaks every time some sort of apocalyptic mood comes over the nation that's boomer-inspired. I remember when we had the long count, you remember the election and the Florida results, we had an enormous rush on Fourth Turning. And certainly after 9/11, it's been, you know, in the top 20 on Amazon through much of last week.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
that's
as a matter
amazing.
Of fact, it's very hard to get now. They're rushing to print thousands of new books and trying to get it out to all of their distributors. Yeah.
So you don't want
to be associated, Tony, with people who talk about gloom and doom. We're not forecasting the end of mankind.
No.
We are talking about what we think is a plausible future. It can be a very bright future, but it's one that is going to test us all. We will each have generational scripts to play, and if we play it well, our children and our children's children will sing our praises. The one thing that we will guarantee is that boomers will be remembered far more for the deeds they did when old than for the riots they had when they were young.
Yes, and I absolutely second that. One of the problems with some of the gloom and doom stuff, is how passive it is. It's the passivity which angers me. There is so much we can do, and there's such strength we can take when we understand the rhythms of history, strength in understanding that others have done this before us. We are not, everything we do is not new in history, that we have parallels and friendships and connections with what has gone before us, and that we can draw a sense of our location in history from that. And I really think that helps us all at moments like this and empowers us.
That's fantastic. Well, we thank you so much, and we wish you well. Any way I can assist you, I'm sure you'll be approached, I hope, by someone anyway, but I'll be pursuing any way I can support you, and I'm sure everyone else here who has any influence will share your message with as many people as they can. And it sounds like your success is assured in a Fourth Turning, since book sales are already moving up.
Thank you. And we'd like to invite your guests there to check out our website, particularly the discussion forum there.
Yes, please.
It's at www.fourthturning.com. Fourth Turning, like the book title, spelled out in letters. And we have a very active set of readers there. It's a discussion forum that's been going online for 5 years now. And I think they would find a lot of the talk there quite interesting, and I would encourage them, on behalf of Neil and myself, to join in.
We definitely will. Is there anyone who has tracked other countries, like, for example, Southern Hemisphere, other portions, small communities?
We have one forum on our Fourth Turning discussion site is called Global Generations. Now, right. We've recently archived a lot of, you know, we changed our software, so we had to archive a lot of the stuff that's previously in that. But it's enormous. Every part of the world, we have an enormous amount of emails, some of essay length, on generational trends, often that people who live in these parts of the world have been noticing themselves. So I would certainly recommend that people go to Generations Abroad or Global Generations and look at the threads into that forum.
You know, as prophets yourselves, we can't thank you enough for giving us a chance to get the spiritual lessons in advance. A chance to take a look at what we have to do to grow as people and as a community. And I don't know what your spiritual beliefs are, but you clearly have been guided by some force to give us this opportunity to look at things in advance rather than just to react to it. And I personally thank you. I'm sure many generations will be able to use what you're sharing. God bless you both.
That's very kind of you to say, Tony.
Thank you, Tony, and we're delighted to have had the chance to speak with you and your friends.